Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The leaked tape shaking up politics inside Iran. The foreign minister and chief nuclear negotiator criticizes the untouchable Revolutionary Guard. Then,
accountability is an essential part of building trust with the community, and public safety requires public trust.
The federal government's long overdue look into racism and policing amid a torrent of innocent lives lost. Also ahead, we're joined by one of the best-selling authors of all time, John Grisham, and the slam dunk in his new book, Sully. And
one of the plaintiffs in that case was so disgusted that he called Princeton a hedge fund that conducts classes.
How massive university endowments plunder American cities. Hari Srinivasan talks to writer and professor Devarian Baldwin.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. The United States Special Iran Envoy is heading back to Europe to work on reviving the Iran nuclear deal. But in the meantime, the curtain has been pulled back on just how Iranian foreign policy works. An extraordinary and frank three-hour recording with the foreign minister and chief nuclear negotiator Javad Zarif has been leaked, in which he criticizes Iran's Revolutionary Guards for undermining the country's diplomatic efforts. He even calls out national hero and assassinated general Qasem Soleimani, and Russia as well, saying all were trying to sabotage the nuclear deal. There's fallout in the United States for chief negotiator, the former Secretary of State John Kerry, after Zarif asserted that he had told him of Israeli airstrikes against Iranian positions in Syria. Kerry denies any such conversation ever took place. Joining me on this is Karim Sajapour, an Iran analyst and senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment in Washington. Welcome to the program, Karim Sajapour. Why do you think this was leaked and why does it matter?
It's tough to say why it was leaked, Christiane. I assume it was enemies of Foreign Minister Zarif who leaked the tape because they don't want to see a future for him in Iranian politics. I don't think that he himself leaked it. Why it matters, it essentially reveals something that you and I have known for a long time, which is that there are essentially two parallel regimes working in concert in Iran. You have a deep state led by the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guards, and these are the forces that build Iran's clandestine nuclear facilities. They cultivate regional militias, they support Hezbollah, they oppose Israel. They're the forces that crush internal dissent within Iran. They take hostages. In some cases, they conduct assassinations. And you have another parallel state in Iran, which is led by President Hassan Rouhani and Foreign Minister Zarif. And they essentially have very little power, but they have accountability. And I think one of the things that Zarif was talking about in this interview is the fact that he is someone who has essentially been powerless. The power in Iran belongs to the Supreme Leader and the Revolutionary Guards. And after 8 years of essentially absorbing accountability for all that goes wrong in Iran, I think he was trying to reveal something that we all knew, which is accountability belongs elsewhere.
So this is what he said to that end about Qasem Soleimani, which, as you know, better than many of us, was kind of a revered figure in Iran. But he belongs to that deep state military industrial complex that you were just talking about. This is the conversation between Zarif and the interviewer, who is the Iranian economist, Saeed Leilaz.
خب من و سردار سلیمانی
اون آن سوی دولت واقعا این
بله من و سردار سلیمانی الزاما هم نظر نبودیم در همه چیز اما احساس میکردیم که باید خدا رحمتش کنه، احساس میکردیم که ما موظفیم که با هم هماهنگ باشیم و این کارو میکردیم. و من اینو میتونم به جرأت بگم، من دیپلماسی رو بیشتر هزینه کردم برای میدان
تا میدان برای دیپلماسی،
تا میدان برای دیپلماسی هزینه شده باشه.
So Karim, as you said, it kind of confirms the nature of the Iranian regime. But what do you think practically it means about, for instance, let's just take the thing that the United States and Europe is very involved in right now, wanting to get back to a nuclear arms control agreement, so to speak, with Iran?
You know, Christian, I don't think this really changes minds in Washington or even Europe per se, and that I think people in Washington have long known that Zarif is really a messenger, not someone who makes policy in Iran. Now, during the Obama years, there was a hope that if we do the nuclear deal with Iran, it could empower these more moderate forces within Iran, like President Rouhani, like Foreign Minister Zarif, and it could transform Iran internally and transform U.S.-Iran relations. I don't think that the Biden administration has that same kind of hope. They want to revive the nuclear deal with Iran for American security reasons, not necessarily because they believe it's going to bring about a transformation in Iran or transform U.S.-Iran relations. And I suspect the Europeans the same. But as I was listening, and I listened to the full three-hour interview in Persian, Christian, and as I was listening to it, and this clip that you just played about Zarif talking about the assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, it struck me the whole time that Zarif was describing his job as somewhere between like a janitor and a firefighter, in that he was essentially tasked with cleaning up the mess of the Revolutionary Guards and bringing the country out of crisis. And he was told at times to tweet things and say things which he knew to be dishonest. And, you know, he was in a very difficult position these last 8 years, and I think he's now wants to come clean, perhaps, on some of these issues.
This was sort of, I guess, labeled as a series of interviews with the outgoing ministers for historical reasons. That's how the interviewer labeled these. And certainly he had a long conversation with Zarif. Were you surprised, as others have been, in the revelation by Zarif about Russia not necessarily, you know, playing good cop in the Iran nuclear negotiations or with the deal, kind of saying that Russia was quite happy to see it sabotage? Let me just play this little excerpt on Russia and Soleimani.
ماه افتاده یه مرور بکن. فقط کافیه مرور بکن. آخرینش حمله به سفارت سعودی و گرفتن دو کشتی آمریکایی بود، ولی اولینش اونا نبود. اولینش سفر سردار سلیمانی به مسکو بود.
اون سفر تحت کنترل شما نبود؟
خیلی. اون سفر به اراده روسیه شکل گرفت.
خب نه به اراده روسیه ما. نباید از طریق وزارت خارجه به سردار سلیمانی.
وقتی که اراده روسیه بر این است که دستاورد وزارت خارجه رو نابود بکنه، حتما از طریق وزارت خارجه عمل نمی‌کنه. آقای
دکتر حرف بسیار سنگینی میزنید.
حرف بسیار سنگینی میزنه.
So Russia is involved along with China and the Europeans in getting that nuclear deal, you know, back together again. What do you think Russia's game is in this?
Christian, there is a widespread belief within Iran, and frankly, I to some extent share this view, that Russia benefits from an isolated Iran. Russia doesn't want to see Iran emerge from its 42-year isolation for a variety of reasons. Number one is that right now, after Russia, Iran is very competitive with Russia in terms of its reserves of natural gas. But Iran, by virtue of the fact that it's isolated, it's under sanctions, it hasn't exploited its vast gas reserves. So it's not really competing with Russia. Number two is that as long as Iran is isolated, Iran is very dependent on Russia strategically. So Russia doesn't want to see a U.S.-Iran rapprochement because they know that Iran would be far less interested in cultivating its relationship with Russia as it would the United States. And lastly, In some ways, Iran, Russia likes the fact that Iran is a thorn in the side of the United States. Now, all that said, I haven't seen the evidence that suggests, as Zarif alluded to, that Russia is has been actively trying to undermine the nuclear agreement. I think that Russia, by and large, has supported both the original JCPOA and its revival. But I do agree with Zarif that Russia doesn't benefit from an Iran which has emerged from isolation or a U.S.-Iran rapprochement.
Let me ask you about a very human, you know, pawn in this struggle between Iran and the West. This is particularly between Iran and the U.K. Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe has yet again been given an extra year of imprisonment. She's not yet back in prison, but then another year of being banned from leaving the country and being able to see her husband and her daughter who are here in the UK. And the former UK Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, said, "This is so distressing. Iran's cruelty seems to know no bounds. Impossible to imagine what the family are going through today. Key question is why the debt issue is still not settled, given the UK accepts that it owes this money. And that debt is about tanks and other military equipment that Iran paid for and has not received." So describe how the Revolutionary Guard and the hardliners are using individuals to, you know, to negotiate with.
You know, Christian, my heart breaks for Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe. I know her husband, Richard, who has been incredible throughout this incredibly painful ordeal. And it is true that the Iranian government, it's almost as if they take pleasure in tormenting people, especially people who, you know, have gone back to Iran to visit family. They're dual nationals because of their love of country, their love of family. One of my dear friends of 20 years, Siam Aknamazi, has been a hostage for over 5.5 years. And in both cases, both Nazanin's case, Siamak's case, the case of other dual nationals, this is a very tricky problem to resolve, because if you give in to the demands of the Iranian government, and it's oftentimes, I've been told from Siamak's family that the Revolutionary Guards wanted $1 billion for his release. And if you're the United States or the UK government and you give in to those demands, you are essentially incentivizing the Iranian government to continue to take hostages. At the same time, if you don't succumb to those demands, then your dual nationals are kept as hostages. So there are no easy ways to resolve this issue, but I do think it will take a collective international effort to make clear to the Iranian government that you're not going to benefit from hostage taking. It's been over 42 years now since the hostage crisis of 1979 that Iran has been using hostage taking as a tool of statecraft. And I do think it's going to take multilateral diplomacy to deter that in the future.
Very quickly, a last question. Obviously, all of this is happening, not just with these negotiations, but with the Iran election coming up. It's the end of the so-called centrist Hassan Rouhani and Javad Zarif. Their terms are up. Who do you think stands to benefit, and what will that mean for Iran relations with the U.S. and the West?
You know, Christian, what Zarif was alluding to in this leaked interview is that Iran has been essentially transforming into a military regime. For years, it was a country ruled by clerics. But over the last decade or two, it's been transforming more into a country ruled by the Revolutionary Guards. And it could well be that an alumnus of the Revolutionary Guards becomes the next Iranian president. But even if they aren't, the country, the Islamic Republic of Iran, is transformed into really more of a military dictatorship than a clerical dictatorship. And I think it's a regime which is going to continue to prioritize its revolutionary principles ahead of the national and economic interests of the Iranian people, unfortunately.
It's really fascinating to get that glimpse inside. And thank you for your analysis, Karim Sajapour. Next, to the U.S. justice system. For the second time in a week, the Attorney General Merrick Garland has announced a Justice Department investigation into a local police department, this time launching his probe into Louisville Police Department, that's in Kentucky. It comes more than a year after Breonna Taylor was shot and killed there. And even with the conviction of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, Washington Post data shows that 17 black people have been shot and killed by police just since that trial began. So how can the federal government stop this from happening? Joining me on this is the activist and former Kentucky State Representative Charles Booker. Welcome to the program. Just that figure, 17 people, black people shot and killed, just in the time period of the Derek Chauvin trial and since then, is just an alarming and extraordinary and unacceptable fact. So what do you think the Attorney General and his investigations can actually do?
Well, first of all, you're right. It is an alarming fact. It's distressing, and it speaks to the systemic challenges that we are facing, and it rises to the point that our federal government has a responsibility to not only get involved and investigate, but to help chart the path forward on systemic change. And I join my entire city and our Commonwealth in welcoming the Attorney General's investigation, because it is clear that there are deep structural problems, and we can't ignore them, avoid them. We have to take them on so that we can have real accountability and ultimately real justice.
It's been certainly the people of your state and your city have been calling for that, of course, since the murder of Breonna Taylor more than a year ago. What are the specifics? Because we hear, for instance, I think there have been something like 140 different reforms and other proposals in some 30 states around the nation. What exactly are the most important things? Pick three of the most important things that you think should happen that can stop this excessive use of force and the unaccountability.
Well, first of all, to frame this whole conversation, what we're fighting for and what we expect out of this investigation is a chance for us to further our path to community safety. We actually want our family, our loved ones, from every corner to be safe in their homes. And that does include, in large measure, immediate reforms to our justice system and policing. And it lifts up a lot of the elements that are involved in the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, you know, addressing qualified immunity. On my way to meet with you, I drove by a minister who was slammed down in the street, punched repeatedly for what would amount to be jaywalking, for carrying a cross, talking about the need for justice, and also understanding that we have to make sure that our dollars are going towards actual public safety. Now, coming from the west end of Louisville, the hood, I've seen law enforcement engage our community as if we are enemy combatants, and having militarized operations does not keep the community safe. So how do we invest in true holistic safety? And the bigger conversation, which is really what Breonna Taylor forced us all to dig into, is how do we address poverty? How do we stop criminalizing it? And how do we make sure that all the agencies of government are accountable to it? And that's a deeper investment that we have to commit to beyond just saying that there are a few bad apples in law enforcement. This is a systemic problem.
Now, just to note, even in this climate, the trial of the former officer who's charged in the connection with Breonna Taylor's death, that's in your city, it's been pushed back to February 22nd. I don't know, that speaks volumes in and of itself. Now, the mayor of Louisville has welcomed the AG's investigation, and this is what she said.
The reality of it is what the DOJ is doing is they're bringing more resources, drilling down in greater detail, and also providing the guidance of what it is the federal government wants to see nationally from law enforcement agencies. And there has to be clarity and uniformity on that if we're ever going to be in a space where policing is a profession that we can be proud of in every corner of America.
So, of course, that was the police chief. I'll get to the mayor in a second. But she seems to be, you know, wanting some kind of uniformity of regulations. We know that Maryland, which I think was the first state to enact the Officers' Bill of Rights, has now overturned that. We know that other jurisdictions are saying, OK, you've got to stop just pulling people over for traffic offenses or for, you know, things like lights or registration or seatbelts and things, because the overwhelming number of people who are pulled over are black citizens, and that leads to these confrontations. Things like that. Is that where it starts?
Well, first of all, this is a conversation about structural racism and inequity. And you're right, it does start in very real terms about how this affects communities like mine. And I've shared here recently that when I was a teenager, I had an officer pull me over for a rolling stop, walk up to the vehicle and withdraw a firearm. I'm thankful to be here today. But the fact of the matter is this deeper conversation in the police chief and the mayor are correct to welcome this investigation. That is affirming, but it's also distressing. The fact that we need an investigation is a concession that our leadership has not been able to address these systemic challenges, which is also why we need federal leadership. Mm-hmm. And in my own right, understanding that, I've launched an exploratory for U.S. Senate to consider a run against someone like Rand Paul, who denies that racism even exists. So we do need leadership at the federal level. And this investigation that Attorney General Garland has announced is timely and it's overdue.
So let me just play, in fact, what the mayor of Louisville said about this.
It's no surprise that the policing is at a real crossroads in America right now, and every mayor is looking at their police department and saying, how can we make sure that practices are constitutional, there's no discriminatory practices. In my view, it's just a time for a total top-to-bottom review for all of policing in America.
So, you know, I just want to know whether you think that's genuine, because I have heard from activists, certainly since the trial and the conviction of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, that police departments all over the country, you know, were looking at that and know that in order to protect the good police, they have to do something, because this is bad for them as well. On the other hand, you've got police unions who are very, very powerful, and they are actually strongly pushing back on a number of these reforms.
That's exactly right. And, you know, in terms of whether the words that our local leadership are saying, whether they are genuine or not, there's a first point to know that words are important. And what he's acknowledging is very true. But in the same vein to what you were mentioning with, you know, with unions and law enforcement and how there's been a push and pull on how we actually effectuate change, it speaks to the systemic nature of this challenge. And I see that our local leaders are essentially saying we can't do this alone and we need leadership at the federal level that's going to step in and give us the support we need. And again, that's why I feel the urgency of telling that story in my own right as a young Black man from those same circumstances. And I'm asking everyone that's watching us now, because I know the world is watching, we're still mourning for Breonna Taylor, mm-hmm. to go to charlesbooker.org and understand what we're trying to build here, and not just lifting up an opportunity to change our political dynamic, but to actually get these real results that we sorely need.
And again, you know, because so much of this is local, and as we've established, there is no uniform national, federal set of rules or accountability or practices. So I've been reading also that some cities, for instance, where communities try to hold police accountable, many of them are civilian oversight boards, if you like, they get a huge amount of pushback. And we've seen them say that they don't actually have any teeth. There's literally not a huge amount they can do other than, you know, maybe write a few reports.
Well, you know, one of the biggest challenges is the fact that when you look at municipal budgets, for instance, here in Louisville, our law enforcement, their budget is more than every other agency combined. And so when you have built this institution that is in the vein of public safety, which we all want, we have essentially prevented ourselves from having hard conversations about how do we actually get to public safety. Because when you talk to people in uniform, they'll tell you that in a moment of health crisis or someone that's unhoused that needs help, they're not often prepared to address them. And, you know, I've actually shared my own story. We're seeing here nationally where, you know, folks are sitting in their cars. It's an air freshener hanging in the rearview mirror, a minor traffic infraction. And the deeper question for us is, how do we actually make sure that we are addressing our laws and upholding our laws, but keeping people safe? And that is, again, why we need to have this conversation at a systemic and structural level and not ignore that this is bigger than just any one officer. And we need men and women in uniform to join us in doing this work. And the people of Kentucky are ready.
What would you say then to President Biden? He's going to give his national address to a joint session tomorrow night. His campaign promise was to establish an oversight commission. He hasn't talked about that. He hasn't done it. What do you think he needs to say about this? He's obviously said a lot about the George Floyd Act, and he's spoken a lot about these crimes that are being committed. What else should he do now?
Well, I agree with you that President Biden has spoken to the fact that systemic and structural racism exists. He has spoken about his support for the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act that needs to happen. This is also a chance for us to show bold leadership. Now, if we know that the challenges of effectuating or affecting community and public safety stem back to deeper structural issues of inequity and poverty, how do we get to the heart of that? If we know that this disproportionately impacts black communities and poorer communities, how do we make sure that folks are living healthy, gainful, thriving lives where they have more resources, they have money in their pocket, they have opportunities to dream in advance, they have the health care that they need? We have to dig in and have this deeper conversation beyond just what police do or don't do. And I hope that he leads on that.
Well, now is the time. Everybody's watching on this. Charles Booker, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Now, questions of justice have long been central to my next guest, life and work. Best-selling author John Grisham began as a small-town lawyer before he perfected the modern legal thriller. Grisham has sold over 300 million copies of his 46 books. 28 of them have been consecutive number one bestsellers. His latest book is about the sports arena. Suli follows a Sudanese teenager who leaves the Civil War at home to play college basketball in America. And John Grisham is joining me now from Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome to the program. I wonder if I could get you first to weigh in on the discussion that we've been having, because it's been a central focus of your work and your life as well, and that is social justice, racial justice, and you've written a lot about the legal system. What do you make of what's happening in the country now and how it's changed? For instance, the blue line cracking during the Derek Chauvin trial.
Well, first of all, thank you, Christiane, for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm certainly no expert on policing or police procedure, but my wife and I watched the early morning news this morning, just appalled, at, like everybody else, at the number of shootings. The white policemen shooting unarmed black people and killing them. The numbers are staggering. 17, as you said earlier with your other guest. I don't know how to solve the problem except just stop shooting and stop killing. Apparently, these policemen are trained that if someone is resisting arrest and trying to get away, it's okay to go ahead and kill them. That's what's happening time and time again, and that is not the way the police should be handling this. Listen, there are a lot of black people and brown people who don't want to be arrested because they don't trust the court system, the jail system, the penal system, the legal system. They don't trust the system, okay, with good reason. They've been through it before, or they know somebody who has. And so there's a great deal of distrust. They don't want to be arrested. And most of these people are unarmed, the ones who are being shot. For charged with small, petty crimes. This is not violent crimes they're charged with, and they're being shot and killed. The shooting has got to stop at some point. We have many, many problems to fix after that, but for right now, just stop the killing.
Your books have tackled, a lot of the issues of justice. Obviously, they've been legal thrillers. They've been made into movies. Everybody knows about them because they've been so popular. Has it been your experience that writing these stories, whatever they might be, in this realm, can also affect not just awareness but some social change?
Well, I'm not sure about change. Certainly awareness, because I started writing about wrongful convictions about 15 years ago. And this is another area of police abuse and prosecutorial misconduct. This is not killing people in the street. This is sending people away to prison for 20 and 30 years for somebody else's crime. Almost every wrongful conviction, and there are tens of thousands of those in this country, and tens of thousands of innocent people in prison, almost every wrongful conviction goes back to bad police work and bad conduct by the prosecutors. And they're immune from prosecution, immune from liability. And so I have lived through that a lot with my research and with my books. And I want to say, yes, that by raising awareness about wrongful convictions and also mass incarceration and also other problems in our judicial system, I hope that raising awareness can somehow lead to change. I'm not leading that parade. I write first and foremost as an entertainer, writer of popular fiction, but sometimes I work in the issues, and I think those are better books. I would like for people to think more about these issues.
So let's turn to Suli, because that's your new book, and you've taken on the big issue of basketball, well, actually also of civil war, of migration, of having to leave your home. Yeah. Tell me why you decided to focus on South Sudan, the civil war there, and this character, Samuel Suleiman.
Well, it goes back to the desire to write a book about college basketball. I've written three other sports books, two about football, one about baseball, and I really enjoy watching college basketball. We're big fans, and for a number of years, I've thought about the idea of a college basketball novel. Didn't have the story until about a year ago, and several things happened to bring the story together. One was another story, a magazine article about a team from South Sudan playing here in the U.S. in the summertime showcase camps, young players who dreamed of playing college basketball and then professionally here in the States. And so the kids are they're fantastic athletes and wonderful players, and they play with a really infectious style of exuberance that college coaches really like. So that was the initial inspiration. And so finally, about a year ago, when March Madness was canceled in March of last year, it was a shock to all of us. At that point, we realized that the pandemic is pretty serious if they're going to cancel March Madness. And it was for sports fans, that's the biggest sporting event of the year for us as sports fans. And so when it was canceled, it was a big deal. And that was sort of the impetus to go ahead and get my basketball fix by writing a novel about basketball. And again, I picked South Sudan because of the interest I have in the players from there. There have been a lot of great players to come here. It's a country with a terrible past, a lot of suffering, a lot of death, a lot of wars for the past 50 or 60 years. And it's a dangerous place. I couldn't go there because the State Department warned us not to go there, and also COVID kept us at home, so I've never been. But I was able to find a lot of books about South Sudan, some books written by the refugees. And even in that context of the novel, I wanted the reader to be aware of what these refugees are going through, what happens to them. There are over 2 or 3 million now refugees from South Sudan living in other countries in what's becoming permanent refugee camps. These people are displaced. They cannot go home. They have no home to go home to. And it's a tragic, it's a humanitarian crisis that gets worse every day.
You know, writing this book about this story of Suli, which is, you know, it looks like he has an overnight miraculous success, but there is, you know, tragedy in the book and the way it ends as well. You know, are you also telling Americans a lot about this part of the world that they may not have known about, that it's not just about war, they also produce amazing sports people?
Yes, absolutely. They produce some incredible athletes, you know, track and field stars. But also, you mentioned Luol Deng, probably the greatest of all South Sudanese basketball players, NBA All-Star, as you said, played at Duke for 1 year and has been very, very successful off the court. But these guys give back. They give back to their country. They're the bright spots in a very dark history of this country, where the people are striving for some sense of safety and decency, and they just want education. They want the wars to stop. They want the rebels to, you know, a peace agreement. And I think the basketball players, some of these famous NBA stars, are having a huge impact in that country, as they are in other countries in Africa.
I don't know how much of the ending I should give away of this book, but certainly Sully has experienced tragedy. He's lost members of his family. Others of, like his mother, has ended up in a refugee camp. Yeah. You don't exactly have a happy ending.
No, I'm not crazy about happy endings. Sometimes they're okay. It's all fiction, so I can do what I want to do with the ending, but I prefer the endings that are complicated, endings that are not expected, and sometimes endings that are sad. That's just the art of storytelling. But it was actually inspired by something that really happened 35 years ago to a great college basketball player who died shortly after the draft. I'm not giving the ending away. Let's don't spoil the ending of the book. But it's a sad ending, but it's also a very compelling read. And I'm already getting dirty letters from people who don't like the ending. So that's part of it.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you a slightly different question? Later in the program, we're going to be talking a little bit about sexism and the current EU Commission president. But I wonder, as we talk about accountability, over the past years, we've learned a lot about misogyny, you know, in the entertainment industry, too. And just this month, there are new disclosures in publishing, authors with known histories of mistreating women tacitly supported by the industry. You know, you're a longtime veteran of film, of books. Do you think your business, the entertainment business, is doing enough to hold their own accountable and to reform?
I really don't know if I could answer that, Christiane. My world is publishing, okay? My world is not Hollywood. I don't make movies. I don't go out there. I don't hang out with people who do. I've had a lot of success with Hollywood because somebody else made the movies and I stayed out of the filmmaking process. So I can't really speak to that. I'm no expert. As far as publishing is concerned, again, I'm detached from that. I don't know many people in publishing. I don't work in New York. I work on a farm here in Virginia. And so I'm really out of the loop when it comes to those people, their problems, and whether or not the industry is doing enough to police itself. Over the years, I've not heard of serious problems in publishing. You're always going to have a few episodes here and there, I guess. But I'm not aware of that. And I probably would not be because I'm not caught up in it.
Very, very last question then. 10 seconds to go. Your next book, you write about one a year almost. Will it be back to the police, the legal thriller, or are you going to continue in sports?
No more sports books anytime soon. I'm halfway through with the next legal thriller that will come out in October. I start in January each year and finish in late June. The book is called The Judge's List. It's about a judge who's up to some bad things, and our protagonist is going to track him down.
Got it. John Grisham, thank you so much for joining us. And next, Devarian Baldwin is a historian, a social theorist, and professor of American studies at Trinity College in Connecticut. His new book, In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower, How Universities Are Plundering Our Cities, it is about higher education's sometimes negative impact on black and brown local residents. Here's Hari Srinivasan speaking to him about all of this.
Christiane, thanks. Devarian Baldwin, thanks for joining us. Your book lays out an argument that essentially universities have amassed enormous, unchecked amounts of power. You're not just looking at small schools or big schools or lesser-known schools or Ivies. I mean, you take apart, for example, Yale and New Haven, which are in many ways synonymous. So tell me, how, for example, does Yale get more out of New Haven than New Haven does out of Yale?
Colleges and universities are designated as nonprofits as indicated by their 401c3 status in the tax code, which means that their property is tax exempt. Now, the money that comes from property taxes, it is what directly underwrites things in the public good, like schools, public secondary schools, trash removal, snow removal, thinking about Texas a month ago, the electrical grid. So the basic infrastructure of cities comes from property taxes. So as Yale became not only one of the biggest landholder in New Haven, the biggest employer in New Haven through this knowledge economy of tech and science and property holdings, people began to see a direct correlation between the money that Yale was not paying in property taxes and its grand expansion and the struggling conditions of the city of New Haven.
Because the city still has to pick up the trash on campus.
That's right. And the campus still benefits from the infrastructure that the city provides.
So when you look at this, look, colleges and universities are going to say, what about all of the benefits that we bring to the public commons, the public good? So, for example, you look at Princeton and you say they've got a bunch of patents, they've got amazing discoveries, they've got lots of things that the campus and the students and the faculty have helped discover in lots of different fields. So isn't that good? What's good for Princeton? Isn't that good for the township of Princeton?
Well, for some, but not for others. And the great thing about this project is I was able to conduct over 100 interviews, and I focused on the stories of people who I say live in the shadows of the Ivy Tower. And so one example of those kind of people are the residents of the historically Black Witherspoon Jackson neighborhood that surrounds the campus of Princeton. In 2015, they began to realize that their property taxes of the homeowners was going up, and they wondered why, what was going on? And so they began to do some investigation and realized that because they were sitting next to Princeton buildings that were producing millions in royalties, but remained tax exempt, their taxes were going up and they were reaping no benefits from these discoveries and innovations that were being created on this campus. And so they filed a lawsuit and won millions of dollars because it became clear that, again, there was a direct correlation between the cost they were paying, the burden they were taking on in the city infrastructure, and the money in property taxes that Princeton was not paying while reaping benefits from that very exemption and that financial shelter. One of the plaintiffs in that case was so disgusted that he called Princeton a hedge fund that conducts classes.
So, aren't there universities that do contribute beyond taxes, right? I mean, is there something that universities are doing besides the tax-exempt status that makes such land ownership problematic for the communities that they're in?
They're buying up properties, and thereby they're setting the land values of these properties. And not only are property taxes of homeowners increasing, but landlords are retrofitting rental properties to meet the needs of students and faculty at the cost of single working class families. At the same time, they are engaging in healthcare work. They receive a tax exemption, the medical schools and the medical facilities receive a tax exemption because they're supposed to be providing indigent care. But what we're finding out in places like Yale New Haven Hospital and Johns Hopkins Hospital is that they're not being totally transparent about the kinds of indigent care they could provide. So they're focusing on profitable cancer research and plastic surgery, while at the same time, when they do serve these communities, when the neighborhood residents aren't able to fully pay, they're putting liens on homes and pursuing lawsuits against working class Black and brown people, when in some cases, the lawsuits or the care they're offering probably could be covered by the indigent care mandate and the cost could be reduced. And then all of these economic development projects that are coming out of universities are protected by private and quasi-private university police forces that are engaging in acts of racial profiling when you have predominantly white universities in Black and brown neighborhoods. And then on campuses, you have Black and brown students who don't want to get understood as being a local, having to wear the armor of university paraphernalia so they don't get profiled and mistreated. I spent months talking to a young Brandy Parker on the south side of Chicago, who told me that as the University of Chicago's jurisdiction extended beyond the campus, almost all over the south side, in his Woodlawn neighborhood, he got stopped 3 or 4 times a week by the University of Chicago Police Department. Sometimes before the car even stopped, police officers jumped out with the standard mantra, where the drugs at, where the guns at. This is a young man who never had been in the police system, endured this. So you can say, yeah, he didn't get shot, he didn't get beat up, but the trauma and the inconvenience and the feeling of always being under surveillance in a quasi-university republic with its own economic development and its own police force. Senator Mary Washington in Baltimore, when Johns Hopkins was attempting to create its own private police force, she described it as being like putting a Vatican City in the middle of Baltimore. Because of the control that these universities have over these neighborhoods.
We're having this conversation in the wake of what the verdict with George Floyd. And I'm wondering, what kinds of measures do you think could trickle down from what police departments are looking at now and what campus police should be looking at?
What's important here is to understand is that as, let's be honest, white parents send their children to these schools in these black and brown neighborhoods, they began to lobby university presidents to do something as their kids began to live in off-campus housing. So in cities across the country, universities have entered into memorandums of understanding with city governments to give university police either jurisdiction over areas, targeted areas beyond the main campus, or either jurisdiction over the entire city. And so on top of that, if these are private university police, they are not subject to Freedom of Information Act policies. So they can police and not even talk about it. So these, again, are private security forces. And even when they're public university police, they police in ways that are governed by protecting the university interest. Now, we all know the biggest crimes on campus are, and primarily white crimes, are sexual violence and substance abuse. They don't police that well. And it's not because of incompetence, it's because that's not the focus. Because to make continual announcements about the levels of sexual violence and substance abuse on campuses, that would undermine the university brand. So that's not their intent. So they've turned outward in a way to protect the brand, to police and show that even though we are in a poor black and brown neighborhood, your children will be protected through a show of force. So some of the recommendations that we've seen in the broader sense can be applied and actually can come out of universities. The university could be a model for police reform and in some cases, police abolition or defunding. So for example, when I spoke to Senator Washington in Baltimore, she pointed out that as we're talking about thinking about ways to shift services and resources from police, because we know that 80% of police stops don't require an armed confrontation. It's primarily social services, domestic disputes, et cetera, that we need to shift the money that has all been funneled into policing budgets towards social services that have been cut. So at a university where you have an institution of higher learning with a public health or medical school, where else could we start than to have at least a police officer paired with a public health professional or shifting the burden from policing to public health and community safety? University could be a model for defunding or police reform, police abolition activities. And community residents in these campuses have been calling for it for decades.
Being one of the largest landowners in a town, I'm assuming, comes with some political power, especially if you are going to have a new real estate development project that hopes to bring new funds, new energy into an area.
When the Columbia University a few years ago was pushing to build its West Harlem campus over a 16-acre area, both student and community journalists found that the university had put money into state agencies as a way to encourage them to use their eminent domain powers to identify certain properties in the area as blighted so the university could gain control. When this was discovered, a lower court judge described the university's efforts to use eminent domain as mere sophistry. But because of the leverage and the power of universities in governance, the higher court argued that, well, because a university offers a public good, because it produces jobs and it can bring investments to the area, that it is legal. That, you know, because of Kelo versus the city of New London in 2004, a year before Columbia began to expand, it was legal to say that eminent domain could be used not just for public use, bridges and tunnels and roads, but for a general public good that didn't even require public accessibility. And so a university could gain access to a whole neighborhood and develop, you know, drugs and technological discoveries, even though there's no guarantee that once they do that, that it will come into a public market, right? So what's the public good here, right? You still got to pay into it, even if it's discovered on a university campus with federal money that is free to the university. You can turn it to the private market. The university can make millions. Is that a public good? Good question.
What have you noticed during the pandemic? I mean, we've seen the statistics that enrollments are down at universities and colleges around the country. At the same time, we've seen some big sort of austerity measures being taken by colleges and universities. We've also seen like what qualifies as an essential versus an expendable worker on a labor force in campuses. What are the things that strike you about what's been happening in this past year?
Yeah, so most people don't even acknowledge that. Because universities are, in many cases, the largest employer in our cities, and we're not talking about faculty, we're talking about low-wage workers in the cafeteria and maintaining the grounds, support staff, and these are primarily Black and brown women. Universities set the wage ceiling in many cities. So whatever they pay will determine what other industries have to pay in their cities. That's important to acknowledge. So during the pandemic, scholars and activists discovered that, for example, Harvard, which made money in their kind of financial coffers, in their investments during the pandemic, and also received millions from the CARES Act. They're using the pandemic to claim austerity measures, which meant cutting jobs in these low-wage areas. And so they did offer furlough with wages for those who are directly employed by the university, up to 3 months. But those who are employed through a subcontractor, which is becoming a larger trend, that most universities are now working on contracts with subcontractors. So then even if you have a university union, those contracts don't apply to the subcontracted workers, which are becoming the majority. So at Harvard, the subcontracted workers didn't get covered by the furlough agreements. But then when celebrity alums and the law school started pushing back on social media, it forced Harvard to include subcontracted workers under the furlough. UChicago, they started to take their unused cafeteria food or excess food and package it into meals for families of need during the pandemic. And they began to offer small loans to struggling small businesses. All great. But especially with the food issue, I asked, why isn't this a standard operating procedure? If you can do it during the pandemic, why can't we create an infrastructure where these institutions can take the food they're going to throw away the next day and distribute it to communities of need?
So you in the epilogue, you take us kind of in the opposite direction and show us that there are ways that we can reimagine a relationship between a university and the community it's in.
Yes. So I anchor this discussion in what I saw at the University of Winnipeg. They built housing that was available to both university affiliates and residents at a range of financial levels, from premium to a market rate to affordable rate to rate geared to income. They put in arrangements with the student government to open up daycare slots for people that were in need, that were living in this housing at a more affordable rate. Most universities use one of the food service multinationals like Marriott, Tedesco, et cetera. What they did was they fired one of those multinationals and created their own called Diversity Foods. At Diversity Foods, 65% of the employees come from marginalized communities, whether that be of color, new Canadian, what we call immigrants, recently incarcerated, single mothers, people from LGBTQ communities, and they're beginning the process of creating them and turning them into shareholders. So they would get shares from the profits. So my point here is that when people say to me, we have to be practical, you're just offering critique, what can we do? What's your solutions? These are my solutions. And we don't have to go north of the border to think about the university-city relationship in a more just and equitable way. We just need to shift our vision from a profit-oriented university to a people-oriented university. That's all we have to do. And these solutions are right beneath our feet.
The book is called In the Shadow of the Ivory Tower. DeVarian Baldwin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for your time.
And finally tonight, remember when the EU's first ever female leader was left standing at that meeting with the Turkish president a couple of weeks ago? Well, she has finally decided to call it out.
I am the first woman to be president of the European Commission. I am the president of the European Commission. And this is how I expected to be treated when visiting Turkey 2 weeks ago, like a commission president. But I was not. I cannot find any justification for what I was treated in the European treaties. So I have to conclude that it happened because I am a woman. Would this have happened if I had worn a suit and a tie?
Now, Turkey, which wants to join the EU, denies the charges, but that is what everyday sexism looks like. And that's it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.